It's the Burt Cohen Show. Talk about dreams. The dream of the State of Israel has been around a long, long time. We're going to look at what the dream exactly was and what's going on now with the State of Israel. Our parents' generation had tremendous dreams, tremendous hopes for the State of Israel. And I don't know, it's a bit changed. A lot of people think these days America is deeply, deeply committed to the survival and the strength of the State of Israel expand as it does. And there's a lot of controversy about it. Is Israel as strong with the public opinion? Is it as strong in Congress as it has always been? Well, we're going to look at the dream of Israel. Our guest today, I'm very pleased to say, is MJ Rosenberg. Thanks for being with us, MJ.
Oh, sure.
Thanks for being with us. Senior Foreign Policy Fellow at Media Matters Action Network, and previously MJ worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years. He was also a Clinton political appointee at U.S. Agency for International Development, and in the early 1980s, he was editor of AIPAC's weekly newsletter, Near East Report. So he AIPAC, of course, is American Israel Public Affairs Committee, very well known in Washington these days. And he was director of policy at Israel Policy Forum. He's currently a commentator on Israel and the Middle East who draws on 35 years of experience as a congressional aide, State Department political appointee under President Clinton, 4 years at AIPAC, on and on. He knows his stuff. Well, thanks again for being with us, MJ Rosenberg. Define what we're going to talk about first. What was our parents' generation's dream for the State of Israel?
After World War II and 1948, when Israel was created, had this image of Israel as a place where Jews would be safe from persecution.
Right.
They had the Holocaust still in their minds.
Sure.
It just occurred within the previous decade or so. They also, 10 to support it as a socialist democracy.
Right.
The model of Israel in those days was the kibbutz. And if Israel had one thing that it, that was identified with in the world, was the kibbutz, which was a commune, a socialist way of living where everybody shares and totally egalitarian.
And it uses a village, quite literally, to raise a child.
Exactly. And it was kind of, even for Jews who didn't choose to live there, it just represented a Jewish democracy, a place where Jews would be safe and a place that would be humane in general.
Mm-hmm. And live by Jewish ethics. That's one thing that's really important, I think, that defines the people Israel, which
right.
is distinct from the chunk of real estate called the State of Israel. But ethics are part of who we are. I am Jewish. Rosenberg kind of sounds like a Jewish name as well.
Right.
what has changed? Tell us, if you would, about the influence of the settlers and religious fanatics in the past 10, 15 years or so. Have they always been there, or is this new and significantly outside of our parents' generation's dream of the State of Israel?
Well, David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, and more than anyone else who can be credited with establishing the state, he was a socialist and an atheist, but he felt that there should be some place preserved within a Jewish state for the Jewish religion. Not a big place. In fact, the Israeli Declaration of Independence does not refer to God. It refers to a formula that Ben-Gurion came up with, the Rock of Israel, which could either be a rock or it could be God or whatever. In the early days, they were very conscious of not a Jewish state so much as a state for the Jews. But then what happened over, I guess the last 20, 30 years is an absolute skyrocketing of the ultra-religious population. There are just about a million, Israel is a country of 7 million, and a million people are ultra-religious. When you talk about our parents' generation, it used to be in those days you would say, American Jews were religious compared to the Israelis. The Israelis were notorious for going to the beach on Jewish holidays. Rather than praying and that kind of thing. So you have a million ultra religious Israeli Jews, and then there's the Russian influx. Starting about in the 1980s. The Soviets, under U.S. pressure, started allowing the oppressed Jews of the Soviet Union to come to Israel. Well, that's another million now. Now you have two sevenths of Israel. The reason I lump them together is they're overwhelmingly right wing. The Russian Jews vote for right wing parties and just hate the left in general. They identify even liberalism with the Soviet Union. So they're not religious, but they're right wing. The ultra orthodox are nationalist and nationalist and religious. These people there's 1 million Jews who came from the Middle Eastern countries. Morocco, okay. Yemen, Algeria, those countries, again, not from a liberal tradition. Uh-huh. The dream, and this is tricky to say it exactly, but the dream that our parents had was of the original Israel, which was a mostly European country that was built by and for Jewish Europeans of a liberal tradition. History changed all that because it turned out that the Jews from the Middle Eastern countries, they needed a place to go. The Russian Jews came. The ultra-Orthodox had a super high a birth rate compared to the rest of the Israelis. And then you throw in what happened in 1967, which is the Six-Day War, which is when Israel won what we now call the occupied territories, the West Bank, Gaza, Golan Heights, East Jerusalem, these areas, and the settlers started moving in. We're now talking about 700,000-800,000 of these settlers who are far to the right. If you add it all up, the Israel of the previous generation, of what you call our parents' generation, is really a minority Israel now. It's not like that at all. That dream, and I'm not saying that it was wrong that these older people got to come to Israel, but the Israel, you remember the book Exodus,
of course,
which was the best propaganda book for Israel ever.
Oh, amazing.
The Israel of that book that was written in 1960 no longer exists. Oh, and in fact, add to the icing on the cake, the kibbutz movement doesn't exist. There are hardly any kibbutzim left. They've been turned into just suburbs. So even this is, and you have governments in Israel that, you know, did everything they could, like right-wing governments under Netanyahu and Sharon and Menachem Begin, who hated the kibbutz and what it symbolized and did everything they could to help destroy that movement. So it's not the same country. It's a Jewish country, but it's not the country it was.
Wow. There's a lot there. We're talking on the Bert Cohen Show with M.J. Rosenberg, who talks a lot about Israel and has been with AIPAC and just really knows his stuff. And I'm already learning a lot about it. And certainly, you know, when I was growing up, Israel was about the kibbutz. I went there in 1981 with my family, and that's what we wanted to see. And I was fascinated by that. It was such an interesting, hopeful possibility. And as you say, it was socialist. No question about that. And now to say that the kibbutz no longer exists, that's a big, big change. You write, MJ, that by now Herzl would be thinking about moving back to Europe. Tell us a little bit about who Herzl was and why would he now be thinking such a thing?
The idea of creating a Jewish state, you know, was the political movement that created the Jewish state, Zionism, was his idea and his dream. And he was totally secular. He was not religious at all. He did not envision a role for religion in the state. He favored, the American way, the separation of church and state. And he was a very cosmopolitan European. And this kind of new chauvinist Israel Herzl viewed Israel as something that it would bring peace to the Jewish people.
Right.
Rather than I know he thought that Israel would be the safest place for Jews in the world.
Right.
And right now it is anything but the safest place. And he also, I don't think he would have imagined an Israel that's, you know, has absolutely no regard for the Palestinians, not the Palestinians who were displaced in 1948 and the Palestinians who were displaced in 1967, that treats them with contempt and thinks that the best way to deal with this minority is to build a wall to keep them out. This is antithetical to, liberalism. And that's what some people didn't like Theodor Herzl because he was totally not religious. But I like that. I like that idea that he wanted a secular state. He wouldn't have thought that the answer to Israel's problems was building walls against the Palestinians and trying to convince the United States to bomb Iran.
No.
I mean, how far off could that all be from the dream?
Well, it certainly has come a long way, and you know, to see this, it's been called apartheid. You know, it's a strong word to use, and a lot of people really bristle at that, the use of that word. Apartheid, of course, went with the South Africa before Mandela came to power, where the minority of whites had absolute control, and they were superior to the black inhabitants of South Africa and just ruled it. Is apartheid, is that too strong a word? Maybe it is.
I don't think within Israel itself there is anything that resembles apartheid.
That's good to know.
I think it within the pre-67 borders in Israel itself, where Arabs, Israeli Arabs, Palestinians are citizens, and with the rights of citizens, that is not apartheid. Obviously, in South Africa, the blacks had no rights at all,
right,
and the blacks were limited to living in these bantustans, these ghettos, and that's not the case in Israel at all. It is apartheid on the other side of the 67 line. It's apartheid in the West Bank. It's the most fundamental way where you have Jewish colonies called settlements, which, control the water, control the resources, control the land. The Arabs are just there to work for them,
right,
to be exploited. And there's so many symbols of it. You know that in the West Bank, the good roads are Jews only roads.
Right.
The Palestinian roads are these, awful, to get from one place to another takes forever. Plus, there's a million checkpoints that the Israelis have set up to make it very hard for Palestinians to move from one part of the West Bank to the other, to go to school, to go to the doctor, to go anywhere. Whereas the Jewish settlers speed along on super expressways to their fabulous settlements, which really are fabulous. I mean, the word settlements are kind of ridiculous. They're kind of a settlement like Beverly Hills' settlement. I mean, they're beautiful. They have the settlements are loaded with swimming pools. The Palestinians are limited to how much water they can use a day for fundamental things like, washing and cooking. Whereas the settlements control, they have all the water they want, and they use it for their pools and their luxurious way of life. It is, I think, I don't know what the exact definition of apartheid is. I think it's basically a system where one group, because of issues of race and who they are, is discriminated against, and all the benefits go to the other group. And with no attempt to change it. It's not like, we have in the United States where, there was a long time a movement to try to change racism, and change that system. Sure. That we have. Like we had kind of an American apartheid system called Jim Crow.
Absolutely.
But the West Bank system that's permanent. As long as the Israelis are there and control all that land and keep the Palestinians off in the corner working for them at terrible wages, it's an apartheid system, but not Israel itself. So what makes me optimistic, and what makes a lot of people optimistic, is imagining an Israel without the cancer of the occupation. Cut out the occupation. The West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem should be a Palestinian state in which the Palestinians are in control of their own destiny. Israel still will have a large Palestinian minority, but it'll be a Palestinian minority with rights, as they have now. It's more than anything else, it's the occupation that's Israel's curse.
MJ, it must have been quite a process for you personally to go through, having worked for AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, for a long time, and working on behalf of the State of Israel. I don't know if you can share what it may have been like to see that, something had changed, that the dream had changed. What was it like for you coming to this change of heart?
Well, when I worked... I worked at AIPAC from 82 to 86, and I really liked the job. I wouldn't have left but for the fact that I got a better job. And even after I left, I continued helping AIPAC out with doing fundraising events, that kind of thing, just because I really believed in what their mission was, which was to support Israel. At that time, the Palestinians had not agreed to recognize Israel's right to exist at all.
Right.
So it was easy for me to say, which I did say, well, there's no one for Israel to negotiate with. So if there's no one for them to negotiate with, what are they supposed to do? They can't just, they've got to, they need security arrangements. If they're going to give back the occupied territories, they need security arrangements, all these kinds of things. But the first step is that they talk. Well, 1993, I'm already out of AIPAC 7 years. I'm invited to sit on the White House lawn to see Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin shake hands. I'm there with thousands of people, Jews and Arabs. It was an amazing thing to see, and I thought that was going to be the end of the conflict. So at that point, I decided that for me, this conflict is over. Yeah, Arafat got up there and said, I recognize Israel. Rabin said, I recognize the PLO as the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. They shook hands. Rabin subsequently called Arafat his partner. They worked together. Initially, there was, Israel got out of some of the territory. Initially, terrorism exploded because Hamas was opposed to this reconciliation. But within a few years, it ended completely with the Palestinians. By 1999, so the handshake was in 1993.
Right.
By 1999 was the safest year in Israel's history. No acts of violence against Jews at all.
Interesting.
I mean, each year it dropped. So by the end, the Palestinian standard of living was going up. The violence was licked, and so I was totally sold. This is the future. Rabin was assassinated by a right-wing Jew.
Yes.
Netanyahu takes over, and all of a sudden Israel stops living up to its commitments to the Palestinians. I mean, commitments that were spelled out, like they would say, like, Israel has to, there's an 11% withdrawal is from land is supposed to happen on such and such a date. Israel wouldn't do it. And this, Netanyahu and Barak, Ehud Barak, were the first two prime ministers to just say, and Barak, amazingly enough, this was Netanyahu in his first time around. Barak was even worse. He was one of these ones. He was from the Labor Party, and he had to show he was tough by giving nothing up to the Palestinians. And by 2000, the whole process collapsed. At that moment, because of what I knew about how the Israelis had torpedoed the process, I mean, it wasn't the way the propaganda put it out that the Palestinians started terrorism. That wasn't it at all. I mean, what they call the Second Intifada began right. when Ariel Sharon, who was the leader of the right-wing opposition, intentionally went up to the Temple Mount, to this Arab Muslim holy place, brought 2,000 cops, and soldiers with him, and basically said, we Jews are going to take everything. We're going to hold everything. And next thing you knew, he was elected prime minister, and we all know what kind of prime minister he was. With all those things going on, was a revolution for me, because nice Jewish boy that I am, I always thought the Israelis and the Jews were right. But then I came around to see, yeah, they're right on some things, but in terms of torpedoing, subverting the peace process that Bill Clinton, Yasser Arafat, and Yitzhak Rabin began, it was the Israelis who did that, not the Palestinians. And I stayed with the peace process. By that point, I was no longer the way most pro-Israel people are in this country today, or lobby people, is whatever the Israelis tell them, they switch sides. I wasn't prepared to switch sides. I go to Israel all the time. I knew exactly how Israel backed down from the peace process, and so that's where I've stayed. Yeah, it's pretty depressing. I'm glad there's a Jewish state, but I wish, as you said, talked about ethics.
Yeah.
I wish it was an ethical Jewish state, and it isn't.
Right. We're talking on the Bert Cohen Show today with M.J. Rosenberg, a commentator on Israel and the Middle East, who draws on 35 years of experience in dealing with the subject. And I know, among the the Jewish Americans, we've had exceptionally close ties for a long, long time. They've been sort of an understood, just absolute rock-solid identification between being Jewish and supporting Israel against any and all critics, which emerged, with Israel's founding. But it seems to be kind of weakening. What's happening with the, you hear the term self-hating Jew being tossed around, if a Jewish person has anything in the least bit critical to say about what's become of the state of Israel. How dependent has the state of Israel been on Jewish Americans? And what do you see happening with the Jewish American community on Israel? I mean, my sense is it's still mostly non-critical of Israel, but what's your sense of that, MJ?
Well, my sense is that it's the old people are just as uncritical as ever, and their kids don't care about Israel at all. You know, to me, there's like a great, almost, I don't know if it's a metaphor or whatever, for how much it's changed. When I got involved with Israel when I was in college, which is back in the 60s, and my friends and I, we just really got into, you know, loving Israel, and
sure.
And I never that, you know, a whole bunch of us decided that we would go to Israel in the summer of 68. I also went in the summer of 69, the summer of 70, and the summer of 71. I mean, I've gone many times since then. Each time, and I'm not from a wealthy family, I paid my own way by working and raising, you know, and making the money during the course of the school year so I could go to Israel. You know how they get kids to go to Israel now?
Yeah.
They give them free trips.
That's right.
They have a birthright program. They cannot get Jewish kids to go to Israel unless they give them, and this is a absolute, any Jewish kid, and only Jewish kids, can say, I want my birthright, the right to go to Israel for free. And they go, and they come, and they love it and everything. Fact of the matter is, if you give a college kid a free trip anywhere, they're going to take it.
Yeah, that's likely.
So, in other words, left to their own devices, young Jews don't really care, other than Orthodox Jews, and that's less than 10%, care about Israel much at all. I can tell that from just our, most of my friends, the friends I've had my whole life, are like me. They're always involved with Israel. They've been to Israel many, many times. We know how to get around, you know, everywhere in the place. And none of us have kids who care about Israel. None of us.
And why do you think?
No, they're not anti-Israel.
Right.
It's just not, Jews tend to, Jewish Americans are liberals.
Yes.
And their children are liberal. We voted 80% for Barack Obama twice.
Yay.
A chauvinist Israel, a very much one that, where everything is determined based on the accident of your birth, you know, your ethnicity, your race, your religion, is not going to appeal to young Jews. If the Israel that we talked about of the previous generation existed, you know, and the kibbutz movement was strong, and Israel was a socialist democracy, and it wasn't always threatening to go to war with everybody else in the world.
Right.
It would appeal to kids. But right now, and I see probably forever, unless something dramatic changes, American Jewish kids are not going to be interested in Israel because they prefer the American dream. Because I think they see the American dream, which is a dream of a dream not yet realized, but we're always moving closer to it. A dream where everybody gets, you know, has a fair break. In America, which is more and more inclusiveness, as more and more groups come under the tent. I mean, I watched the Grammy Awards the other night.
Yes.
34 same-sex couples got married on television, on the biggest show of the night. This is like 10 years ago, it would have been inconceivable. But in America, things keep moving to greater and greater inclusiveness and equality, and Israel goes the precise opposite direction. If you're Jewish and you want to get married in Israel, you have to prove that what your birth lines are. Literally. I mean, they don't count converted Jews unless they were converted by an Orthodox rabbi. Half these kids who take these birthright trips couldn't get married in Israel because they're not Jewish enough. That's not going to appeal to younger people. Sometimes when I say appeal to younger people, I think I mean people under 60.
You're right.
I mean, you know, the older, my generation, I'm 66. I'm a 60s person. I'm a Woodstock person. When you're talking about the people who are 65 being hippie-dippies from the 60s who smoke pot, who have gay friends, who are tolerant, who all these things, or who are left liberals or whatever, when that's the older generation, which I am part of now,
as am I,
who's Israel going to be counting on? Right-wing conservatives?
Well,
there are none, not in the Jewish community. There's always been the same 20% that votes Republican, but that's about it. However, right now, the lobby is still powerful because it has the money from the older generation. There's still a significant, you know, there's still a, and there are people in their 40s and 50s, and I suppose 30s too, who are just totally brainwashed into believing everything Netanyahu says. You know, the thing that really to me that is so striking about how ridiculous the Israel lobby is, that some of the same people who would think it's their absolute right, and it is, to say that Barack Obama is totally wrong about everything, or previously that George W. Bush was absolutely wrong about everything, thinks that they are duty-bound to support 100% of what the Israeli prime minister says. That's crazy. I mean, they like a whole different standard. Like, younger people are not going to go for that. That is like, you know, that's going to be gone very soon. But it's not gone yet.
Well, I want to ask about that, and that's exactly my sense as well. And you and I are from a similar generation, the Woodstock generation. I'm a little bit younger, but basically the same generation.
Right.
And Washington, you know, right now, I think the public image of Congress is not a good one, and largely because they seem to be beholden to powerful money interests, period. They are owned lock, stock, and barrel by certain powerful interests. I mean, there's, you know, jokes around that on their suits they should have sew the logos of the various corporations that own them. And they're way out of touch with the average American, I think, in terms of what we want, we the people want, but they do the bidding of those that invest money in their campaigns. I mean, campaign finance reform is really corruption. What about AIPAC and its power in Israel? I mean, you talked very clearly and, you know, I think quite convincingly about they're not the AIPAC, the right wing, doesn't have young Jewish Americans. It's just not there. But what about their hold, AIPAC's hold on Washington? And what about changes? I mean, how can they be so powerful? How important is AIPAC and their incredible strength in Congress to the existence, to the continuation of a right-wing government in the state of Israel?
I think that if there was no AIPAC, the occupation would have ended decades ago. It would have ended about the time that Rabin and Arafat shook hands during that process. AIPAC's money, I mean, it's interesting. AIPAC doesn't give money directly.
Right.
It does it through PACs. It does it by organizing individual donors.
Yes.
But it gives millions and millions of dollars.
Right.
And there's nothing on the other side. You know, on most issues, as having someone who worked in Congress for 20 years, I can tell you, most issues are decided based on who has the money. As you said, we have a thoroughly corrupt and undemocratic system.
Yeah.
And AIPAC is part of it. AIPAC is to the Jews what the NRA is to gun owners, in the sense that it's an extremist organization that does not represent what the actual constituents say. You know, every poll shows that most gun owners favor regulation of guns,
particularly assault
weapons,
yes,
handguns, that kind. But not the National Rifle Association, because the National Rifle Association is backed by the big money of the gun manufacturers. It's not representing individual gun owners. It's the exact same thing with AIPAC. It is not representing Jews. it is representing some very, very, very wealthy Jews. You know, people like Sheldon Adelson, yes, and people like that. Yeah. You remember from the, you know, who was Romney's biggest backer, yeah, and got Hillary Clinton has Chaim Saban. He's her biggest backer. These are money people, and it's what really bothers me is that they speak in the name of Jews.
Right.
And it really can give a bad vibes, you know, a bad impression to Americans to think that this, this really extreme lobby is speaking for all of us. It has 100,000 members, and of those 100,000 members, only a few thousand are the ones that matter, it's the ones with the money. But to be fair to AIPAC, it is no more corrupt than all the other special interest groups dominate everything in this country.
Well,
it really is. I would say if someone said that AIPAC is the symbol of what's wrong with America, I would say they've got problems.
Yeah.
Because they should look into all the other interest groups. This is a totally corrupt system.
Right. AIPAC does what it does. They're very clear. They represent, Israel can do no wrong. And the various other lobbies, the Koch brothers, they represent them. It's the formerly democratic system that has been so corrupted by this money. You brought me to a couple of more questions, MJ. AIPAC's been around a long time, tremendously powerful. They raise a ton of money. What about J Street? Are they a factor? Tell us a little bit about what J Street is. I know they've been trying to have a more moderate presence and a significant presence in Washington. What about J Street?
Well, J Street is created to be the alternative to AIPAC, to be the place for young Jews in particular to go, right, where they can support Middle East peace. I think their motto is something like supporting Israel by supporting peace.
Something like
they
that.
They are the exact opposite of AIPAC, but they're very, very strongly pro-Israel.
Right.
They just think that Israel's survival depends on its achieving peace. They also don't put Israel's interests above that of the United States, which AIPAC does.
Yeah.
However, they don't have any money. Mm. There are no millionaires and billionaires buying up congressmen in the name of J Street.
Mm.
So, you know, J Street gets very excited when a member of Congress agrees to go to their dinner. Well, that's really very nice, but that's not going to get you anything. Or a member of Congress signs one of their letters. You need what it will take to defeat AIPAC. Mm. Well, one, it'll take generational change, which is obvious and inexorable.
Yeah.
That just will happen.
Yeah.
And it will take almost outbidding AIPAC for these congressmen. Under our current system, you have to buy these guys.
Yes.
And AIPAC buys them. And it's like, I don't know if you noticed, in President Obama's State of the Union message, he didn't mention the gun situation this year. Because it's pointless. Last year he mentioned it because of what happened in Connecticut with all those children.
Yeah.
This year he didn't even bother mentioning it because an ugly lobby owns Congress. Well, AIPAC operates the exact same way. And, if there was one public policy wish we should all have for this country, it would be get private money out of campaigns.
Amen.
Every campaign should be paid for out of our tax dollars. And then we'd have a really different politics and policies. And I also, before, some people are going to say that the Christian right is also a big factor supporting Israel, and that if AIPAC didn't exist, it'd still be the Christian right. I want to preempt that question that it comes into anybody's head. They don't matter, the Christian right. They don't give money based on Israel. They just scream and yell. The Christian right and the right wing in general, they are too busy hating, minority groups, immigrants and gays, for them to. Their issue is not Israel. They just scream and yell about it. They don't give the money. You can scream and yell all you want in this country about anything, but if you don't write a check, you don't count.
A big check at that.
A big check, right.
Well, again, you're listening to The Bert Cohen Show. Our guest today is MJ Rosenberg, commentator on Israel and the Middle East. Got a lot of experience with the subject. And one thing that's gotten me quite a bit is people around the world, it seems oftentimes, be curious what your take on this is, confusing the state of Israel with the people Israel. I mean, the people Israel are Jews spread across the world.
Right.
What about the current right-wing government of Israel and anti-Semitism?
Well, I think that that Netanyahu and the Israeli government certainly don't help the image of Jews around the world. To have Benjamin Netanyahu's snarling face at the UN, basically speaking on behalf of all Jews, because he does.
Ugh. You know, doesn't speak for me.
Yeah, he doesn't, but you know, he thinks he does.
And
the last time he was here, he went on Meet the Press, and I always forget the name of that tall Jewish guy who's the host of Meet the Press.
Yeah, I do, but I can't think of it.
Okay. He said to him, he says, Mr. Prime Minister, as the leader of the Jewish people.
Whoa.
Really? Well, maybe he's your leader. He is not the leader of the Jewish people. He's the leader of the political state of Israel. Peter Beinart, who's the best, in my opinion, the best writer on all things relating to Israel and Jews, wrote a column the other day in Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, that was entitled "Netanyahu is not the leader of American Jews; Obama is," and it was really, you know, and it just made the point where, you know, American Jews tend to be, you know, are liberals and our loyalties are to the United States, and it's very important. I get worried when I see organizations like AIPAC making it appear that, you know, that American Jews have mixed loyalties, because we don't. Oh, some of them do, definitely. Sheldon Adelson, the big Romney Jewish guy, he said that he was ashamed that he ever served in the U.S. military during World War II and wishes he had served in the Israeli military. I mean, these people are out of this world.
Whoa.
I mean, but that's not, I mean, you know, the good thing about it is that Jews live all over the United States.
Yes.
And fortunately, I don't think that anyone who lives next door to a Jew in Kansas City is going to think that Benjamin Netanyahu represents them. I mean,
I hope not.
Like, Jewish organizations are so worried about assimilation. Well, too bad. We're assimilated.
Yes.
And if we're not, and in fact, that's why that's why our grandparents and great-grandparents came here.
Right.
Was they not to give up being Jews, but to become assimilated into a larger culture that would accept them.
Absolutely.
And to reward this culture, to reward this country by making excessive demands of it, like AIPAC is right now with its trying to kill the Obama's peace initiative with Iran. That's disgraceful. This is best country ever for Jews in history.
Yes.
And what AIPAC and their friends, their owned friends, you know, the people, they're not really their friends in Congress, the people they bought in Congress,
yes.
What they're trying to do is get America into another war for Bibi Netanyahu. Nice guys, that's really nice. Well, you don't speak for me, and you don't speak for anyone I know.
And why?
But, as with everything else, they speak for the super rich, for the one percenters.
And so many things do break down to that. It's that whole class thing. I mean, it's just face it. It's for real. And just, I don't know. I mean, it's mystified me as to why Netanyahu is so gung-ho on war against Iran. Can you explain it? I don't get it. I mean,
yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with Iranian nuclear weapons, because if it did, he'd support what Obama's doing, because what Obama is, if this process succeeds, Iran will never develop nuclear weapons. I don't think that's his issue. I think his issue is he wants Israel to maintain regional hegemony in the Middle East. He does not. The way it is now, Israel can do what it wants whenever it wants to.
Right.
Who can stand up to Israel? Nobody, not even the United States. a more powerful Iran, even a nuclear Iran. After all, Israel has 200 nuclear weapons.
200?
Not like
how?
Netanyahu considers that such a scandal.
Really?
He has this view of Israel as, you know, a kind of a Sparta that has to, you know, be militarily dominant over everyone. And that's what it is. I don't buy the nuclear thing at all.
Right.
I think it's just a pretext. They're
yeah.
always, it's like the Israelis are always finding these ways to avoid peace and reconciliation. The Palestinians recognize them. They've got this Abbas in there who couldn't be more pro-Israeli if he was an Israeli citizen himself. And they won't negotiate with him. They make all these demands. The Iranians are saying, they're dealing with President Obama, and they're saying that they not only that they won't develop nuclear weapons, it's against their religion to develop nuclear
yes.
weapons. So why not go with that? Why not test them? What is this terrible? It's this, you know, Israel under Netanyahu will, you know, never takes yes for an answer. It's always a part of it is that I think these right-wing Jews fear that the only thing that holds the Jewish people together is fear. So they're always, you know, and I don't know if you said the other day, Abe Foxman, the head of the Anti-Defamation League, went off on the whole thing about how anti-Semitic the United States is.
What?
Yeah, he wrote a thing about that Jonathan Pollard thing and says that he is now convinced that that's all about anti-Semitism. And then he goes on with the stuff about Israel. This is, you know, the usual criticism of Israel's anti-Semitic, all
right.
that. It's like they forgot what anti-Semitism is. And my father told me what anti-Semitism was growing up in Pennsylvania in 1920s. When you had the Ku Klux Klan running around, and every Jew, he used to tell me he played basketball, and when the Jews, were on the field, on the court, everybody's screaming, calling them kikes and that kind of thing. And when Jews couldn't, live in wherever they wanted to live, and they couldn't get jobs in law firms, that's anti-Semitism.
Right.
Get over it. It doesn't exist anymore in this country.
Right.
Whoever experiences it. So what they did was reinvent what anti-Semitism is.
Yeah.
Anti-Semitism is being against the policies of Israel. And in the name of that, they make alliances with the Christian right, which is, in my opinion, is riddled with the old-fashioned kind of anti-Semitism. It's become like everything is a political game for these people. I mean, they're just bad people. And another thing that sustains these organizations, like AIPAC and all this, the amazing salaries these people get to combat anti-Semitism. The head of the Anti-Defamation League and the head of the American Jewish Committee and the head of AIPAC, they all make $500,000 a year, have multi-million dollar packages. I mean, it's a racket. And what will they do if we are able to achieve peace in the Middle East and peace with Iran? Their racket disappears.
They'd be out of business.
Yeah.
Interesting point.
I mean, I remember when I mentioned the day of the Oslo signing at the White House lawn, when I got dressed to go down there, my wife said, what are you going to be cheering for? You're going to be out of business because your whole life has been working for peace, and now there's going to be peace.
Uh-oh,
I said, isn't it great?
Yeah.
I don't think that's the way AIPAC saw it.
Well, as you have said, MJ, and, we're talking about the dream of Israel. Is it dying? It's a sad feeling. Our parents had a wonderful dream of Israel. And you said, quote, we know Israel is committing suicide.
Yeah.
Can there still be a dream? Can the Palestinian dream and the Zionist dream coexist? Is a two-state solution still possible? Can there be a Palestinian state alongside a Jewish state, or is it now too late?
I don't think it's too late, and I think, and this may seem naive considering how pessimistic I sounded all through this conversation, I honestly believe that if the United States draws up a plan, which John Kerry, according to Tom Friedman, supposedly John Kerry is doing, and says to the two sides, this is the plan, two states built on the 67 lines, with the United States providing security guarantees, and that which has always been in every proposed peace agreement, and said, take it, or we're going to reduce aid. They take it. I think that all it takes is the United States saying, you know, just do this. We will not tolerate this anymore. Israel, if you want us to be your one friend in the world, the one guarantee that there will always be a Jewish state is U.S. friendship, and that they're essentially our nuclear umbrella. Okay. If you want that to continue, and it has to continue, then you have to end this occupation. I think if you put that to the Israeli people, they would overwhelmingly ratify it. And if you put it to Netanyahu, he'd have no choice but to accept it. I think it's going to happen. I don't think it's too late for the two states.
But what about Congress? I mean, would they accept that? I can't imagine they would go along with
it. No, because if Netanyahu negotiates it, then AIPAC goes along with it too. And then they don't have the money up against, you know, then no one's holding the money trigger to Congress's head. It's only the only way that AIPAC, you know, the AIPAC plays its role is when they will support anything a right wing government of Israel does.
Right.
So I mean, that's why you often talk about that Nixon going to China thing. We always say only a Nixon could get away with it. Well, maybe only a Netanyahu could. The difference is, of course, is that Nixon really wanted to go to China, and Netanyahu doesn't really want peace, but we could dictate it. We are still the only superpower in the world. We keep Israel alive with $3 billion in aid. We vote with them at the UN. I mean, we're their robots, practically. I mean, really, every international relationship should be a two-way street.
Yeah, thank you.
And unfortunately with Israel, they've gotten used to it being a one-way street.
Well, we'll see if Kerry can pull that off. So
I'm impressed with him. I was never a big Kerry fan, but I'm definitely impressed with him so far.
Well, that's very good to hear that there is some degree of hope. And
I'm impressed with Obama. When Obama stood up at the State of the Union, he made only one veto threat, and he said, "If you send me that the AIPAC sanctions," he didn't say AIPAC. "If you send me that sanctions bill, I will veto it, because it is not in our national interest." Three Democrats have already dropped off co-sponsoring that AIPAC bill.
What is that bill?
The bill is probably dead now.
And what is that bill exactly?
He stood up to them. So I'm not pessimistic. A president with the will could achieve it. And maybe a second-term Obama, who realizes that, you know, it's legacy time,
yes,
and there's not much he can do on domestic stuff because the Republicans don't let him, and he has more latitude as any president does on foreign policy, you know, maybe he can put this over. Well, we can hope that anyway.
Well, what is, just briefly, what is that AIPAC sanctions deal that he said he'd veto?
It's AIPAC has a bill which basically says that that the Iranians would basically have to dismantle all their nuclear stuff, all their civilian stuff. They have to do everything first, and then maybe we'll lift sanctions. In other words, they wouldn't take just the very possibility. I mean, Obama's deal that he reached with them is, as they reduce their nuclear capability, we reduce sanctions step by step. AIPAC says that Israel should, you know, have what it wants, what Netanyahu's demands are, all up front, and then maybe we'll lift sanctions.
And then maybe.
No country in the world would accept that, and that's why AIPAC crafted the bill to kill the negotiations. Uh-huh. But Obama's standing up to them. So miracles happen.
It could happen. Maybe there'll be a Palestinian dream and a Israeli dream in the two-state could happen. Boy, it's sure taken a lot longer than I ever thought it would.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. You have a blog, mjayrosenberg.com is your blog, and you write a weekly column for the Huffington Post if people want to follow what you're doing. Very, very informative here. Thank you so much for being with us, MJ.
Okay,
Rosenberg.
Sure. Thanks for calling me.
All right. Thank you. And this is a song about Palestine. We'll be right back. email me, bert@bertcohen.com. Thanks for listening.
First thing, the occupation started. Palestine was left brokenhearted. Hands down, you won't believe the way they laid their wrath on her. 6 feet under is where they left us. So bad, the way that they were killing us. Too bad, we're not afraid to die when bombs fall from the sky.
Can't explain.
I never thought that we were gonna lose so bad.
They're all insane.
There's got to be a way.
How can we get back on track? Now, tell me how it's gonna be done. Will we win or lose this one? Should be scared. Palestine will never be
there. Yeah.
Next thing,
they're taking all our houses.
Palestine,
right from all the corpses.
Tough luck,
they had to have the guns when all we have are rocks.
All day,
they're killing little babies.
So we're
defending our families.
They said
that we were out of line. Who's wrong? Who's right this time?
Can't explain.
I never thought that we were gonna lose so bad.
They're all insane.
There's got to be a way.
How can we get back on track? Now, tell me how it's gonna be done. Will we win or lose this one? Should be scared. Palestine will never be
theirs. Yeah. Whoa. Whoa.
Whoa. Palestine, we need to get out. Don't care about the fact,
'cause it's all that
Islam has blown out the doubt. There's no way for us to stop.